broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Very good morning to everyone and a very happy new year to you all as well. Welcome back to the first podcast for the year and welcome back, guys.
Hello, Steph.
And welcome back to
Steph,
you.
And welcome back to you. Yeah, welcome absolutely. Back. Been a little bit of a hiatus for you.
Yes, it has been. Lots of travel, but hopefully I'll be in the studio a lot more this year.
You haven't actually just been sipping pina coladas, though, have you?
I have not. I've been traveling around the country.
There's been more to it.
Friday morning is a great time for a pina colada.
It is a good time.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we're all back from leave, so.
True that.
Now, how was your Christmas, guys?
It was quite nice.
Quite nice.
Very relaxing. Yeah. Nice to have a break and a mental refresher, for sure.
Good one.
Although the post-Christmas period changed a bit, obviously, with all the bushfires.
Yeah.
You guys sent our PM home, did you?
Well, yes, we were in Hawaii, so we passed ScoMo and said it's probably best he returned.
Yeah, we tagged him back in.
Yeah.
But just actually on the bushfires, there's been a lot of chatter at the moment about how that's going to affect our economy and local tourism. Joel, you've had your own sort of thoughts on whether that is going to happen or not. Tell me what you guys think about the economic conditions after these bushfires and what impact you really think it will have.
Oh, it depends who you ask. There'll be a lot of people where there's no real impact and a lot of business with no real impact, and then there'll be some businesses that are completely sabotaged.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there'll be some bankruptcies out of it. If not now, then over the next year.
No doubt. I think there was I was watching the news the other day, and there was a bakery in one of the country towns in New South Wales that said that sales were down by more than 50% on this time last year. And this is typically one of their busier periods. And they're really hurting. And, you know, you're going to get some of those small businesses in those country towns that are going to find it really hard. And, but I think in the broader scheme of things, I'm not so certain it's going to be a major detriment or a major positive through the rebuild phase, because a lot of the fires were in the bush.
Mm-hmm.
The last estimate that I saw of houses lost was somewhere around about 1,300 houses, but that was about 2 weeks ago, so I'm not sure. I'm sure that's probably gone up since then. But I would assume that the vast majority of those homes would probably be insured, that the main economic impact would probably pass on to the insurance companies.
Yeah.
There will be a rebuild phase as well, so that'll probably provide a short-term shot in the arm when the rebuild comes along.
Some of the smaller builders will get quite a bit of business.
Government's probably going to be stepping in to help prop up and provide some support there as well, and then you've also got the charity donations that are coming in to help provide some support as well. So I think a lot of the financial impact will probably be passed on through the insurance companies mainly. But yes, you're going to have businesses in those regions are going to quite a few of them are going to struggle, but some of them will probably thrive off the back of this, depending if they're in the hardware industry or something like that.
Yeah. It's those ones that rely on the
No, I was just going to ask what you think about our tourism sector, though. There's some experts are saying that it's going to wipe off up to $5 billion off the tourism side. Do you think that's going to have an impact? Because certainly when we were over in the States, there was a travel issue given out for visiting Australia for the Americans. And I thought about my own circumstances, and if I had planned a holiday, I probably wouldn't think about going to Australia. If you saw the map of Australia and where everything was burning, you'd think the entire country is up in flames. So
are they thinking that it's not a good place to come because of the danger of the fires or because of all the smoke around and the health issues as well?
Yeah, there's been both,
because that's
really
the longer-term effect is going to be that smoke.
Yeah.
Oh, look, I mean, well, the reality is it's just about getting a message out there that a lot of these fires were in areas that most of the tourists don't go to. And look, these will pass. They're devastating, and let's not get that wrong, but they will pass. And, you know, look, it might be just a blip on the radar. I mean, we always have these natural disasters from time to time. It doesn't matter what country you're going to.
Yeah.
It's comparable the other way around with California's wildfires that they have every few years.
Yeah.
And, you know, what reputational damage does that do for their industry, California, to us? Oh,
very little.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it might have a very short-term impact, but not a long-term one.
Yeah.
I don't think California and wildfires. I think California and beaches and Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd still go there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And Australia's not too dissimilar. Beaches.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, on that kind of a topic, I think we'll throw to Joel just to start off with and for you to give us a bit of a market and economic update.
Yeah, look, so a few things have happened since we last spoke. At our last podcast, we went through our predictions of where we thought 2020 would end up. And look, since then, we've noted that just recently, the US and China have actually struck a phase one trade deal. And essentially what that means is that China will now agree to buy an extra $200 billion worth of goods from the US. That $200 billion worth of goods will be taken as of the 2017 export numbers. So gradually over the next couple of years, it'll get to the point where China will be buying around about $310 billion worth of goods from the US so that that they can try and balance up the trade imbalances that were perhaps there initially.
It's more than doubling, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's more than doubling.
So it's a commitment to more than double how much they're buying from the US.
Correct.
What kind of things are they actually buying?
It's mainly agricultural goods and also, to be honest with you, I actually don't know a lot of what else it is, but I'm pretty sure it was a lot around the agricultural goods.
Yep. Farm products.
Farm products and those types of things. Yeah. But it's only a phase one deal. There's still a lot more work to do. So as part of the agreement, the US has also agreed to lower tariffs on around $120 billion of Chinese imports into the United States. Those imports, those tariffs are currently set at about 15% and they're going to drop down to 7.5% as the quid pro quo on the other side of the deal. But there's still a fair bit of work to do on intellectual property, and there's still a fair bit of work to do on some of the other grievances around unfair trade practices and government subsidies being provided by China to their state-owned enterprises. So that is part of the phase two trade deal, and there's still quite a substantial number of tariffs. I think there's still around about tariffs on around about $200 or $300 billion worth of imports into the United States that will remain in place until the phase two trade deal can actually be completed. But all goes well. It's taken and removed one of the biggest risks that we've had hanging over the markets for the best part of the last 2 years. We peaked the stock market, well, certainly the U.S. stock market peaked at the late January of 2018 on the back of these trade wars getting started, and now one of those big overhangs is starting to be removed, and we're seeing stock markets around the world respond quite dramatically. We've seen a major rally in the U.S. Large cap indexes in the S&P 500, the Nasdaq, and the Dow. And now we are starting to see quite a broadening of that strength. So when you go through a bull market and a new bull market gets underway or a new rally gets underway, safer, more well-known, bigger blue chip companies in the initial phase of any rally. And we've seen that again. We saw it back in 2016, 2017 when Trump first got elected. We saw the S&P and the Dow and Dow companies really start to rally. A lot of those blue chips rallied first, and they rallied for about 3 or 4 months. And then eventually, as people became more comfortable with the economic environment, they started to move into some of the more mid-cap and smaller cap areas of the market. And we're now starting to see, probably in the last week and a half to 2 weeks, that rotation and transition is actually starting to play out. So all very healthy signs, because when we want to see higher prices in the stock market, we want to see good broad strength across most issues in the stock market, and right now we're seeing really nice constructive rotation out of maybe not so much out of the big caps, but we're now starting to see, as of last night, the Russell 2000 index, which is a measure of the 1,000th largest company on the US stock market, down to the 3,000th largest company actually outperformed the S&P, the NASDAQ and the Dow last night. And that's the first time I've seen that happen for quite some time. And it was quite a substantial level of outperformance. And even in our share portfolios that had been a little bit soft over the last, not soft in terms of not going up, but not going up as strong as what the large cap indexes had been. We've seen certainly in the last 2 weeks that has turned around quite a fair bit, even in our own client portfolios that we're running. So all goes well. This rotation continuing to move forward, all goes well for a pretty good year, we believe. And while the action has largely been in the large caps, I think that we're going to start to see the mid-cap and the small-cap sectors of the markets around the world, in the US and Australia, start to really grab a hold and outperform from here. And we're seeing some really nice setups that are starting to break out now. And we've been quite active even in the early phase of this week. We've made 3 recommendations just in the last 2 weeks. So looking forward to a good positive year.
Joel, I've got a question on that, because often in the final stages of a bull market, the large caps outperform in the end stages as well.
Correct.
So it's really this top and tail impact.
Very much so.
Yeah, okay.
Yep, no, that absolutely is the case. So when we get to the latter stages of a bull market, we actually often see divergences. So we have a measure that we look at, which is called the advanced decline line. And basically what that does is it measures the number of advancing issues versus the number of declining issues. Now, in the latter stages of a bull market, you often see that the large cap indexes will continue to rise while the majority of stocks are actually starting to fall. And that is largely because most investors tend to, while things are starting to get more riskier, they tend to concentrate their money into the, once again, the type of blue chip stocks that are perceived to be the safest. So you'll tend to see a number of those mid cap and small cap stocks start to sell off towards the end. And that's often a sign that we're getting into the last phase of a rally, and it's probably time to take some money off the table and become a bit more defensive. But right now, everything that we're looking at in terms of strength, breadth, buying power, it's all suggesting that the trends in the stock market are getting stronger, not weaker at this point.
Mm. And so the other thing I think of is that the small cap and the mid cap sectors segments can seriously outperform the large cap segment. So I guess what you're saying is that once that gets underway, those mid caps and small caps really do outperform.
Absolutely.
Through the majority of that bull market run, and it's just the beginning and the end where they might lag.
Most definitely. Okay. Yep. So you want to
interesting.
So in the meat of the trend, in the really meaty part of the trend, that's when you want to start to move into those medium and small cap issues. Yep, most definitely. On a quick note before I finish up, just wanted to make comment on some of the returns for our portfolios over the last 12 months. So, and the performances of the S&P and the ASX indexes. So, for the 12 months to the 31st of December, it was a very strong year for Australian and US stock markets. So, for the 12 months to the 31st of December, the ASX 200 put in a return of, where is it? I've lost it now. The ASX 200 put in a return of 18.3%. Now, when we're taking into account dividends, that equated to a return of, where is it here? I've lost it.
He's back from holidays. He's just back.
Do you remember how to read?
Trying to find the number. Somebody help me.
They were good returns.
24.9%. There it is. Okay. So the S&P ASX 200 Total Return Index, which is the price appreciation plus dividends from the 1st of January to the 31st of December, was a 24.9% gain. Now, that was bested actually by the S&P 500, which produced a return of, drum roll please.
Do you mean hold music?
Well organized this morning.
Fuck, where are you? Look, it was about 31.1%, I remember.
Hope we're not setting a trend for the year here.
My brain's still on holidays, but there we go. That areas, 31.1%. I found it. There it is. So, so a very strong year for equity markets to start the to finish the year. Pleasingly, our portfolios were up around about 39 to 42% when I had a look through after our fees. So, a strong year for the markets, but an even stronger year for UGC clients. Expect again another a very strong start to this year, and all things being equal, we're expecting a pretty good return for our clients as well.
Like that.
There we go. Got it out and got it finished.
All right. Well, look, we might actually take a break so Joel can compose himself.
Yeah. Someone get an oxygen mask.
We'll be back after this little holiday break for Joel.
Yeah.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Okay, and welcome back. Joel's
taking a deep breath.
Back in the seat.
I'm here in body, but not in
you're still
in
having
mind.
A pina colada in Hawaii.
Yeah, that's right.
But look, we're going to throw over to Brett now. And Brett, you're going to talk us through being back to basics with supply and demand. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, given it's the start of the year, whether people have made New Year's resolutions or not, or they're eyeing off this year to be a first-time property investor or a second or third-time property investor or just looking to buy a property, and it's a big financial decision, is it the right time? Where should I buy? What should I buy? These are all the things that they're weighing up. Like anything, and we talk about this regularly, what drives price growth in property? And we always come back to the same basis. It's supply and demand. And the two biggest factors of supply and demand is what I've got some data on today to help give some insight. And then I'm going to pose a theory at the end of this. Ooh. I'm interested to hear your insights.
Ooh, here we go.
So obviously, the biggest factor in supply is dwelling approvals. So dwelling approvals have been quite low in terms of the trend for the last 2 to 3 years because a lot of the developers have probably been a little bit bearish and not seeing the opportunities, and land prices have gotten so big they couldn't see value in developing. But the November data, which is the most recent we've got, shows that dwelling approvals rose nearly 12%.
Righty-o.
So it shows there's a bit more bullishness and a bit more positivity about producing new stock in the market. So that means dwelling approvals are rising. The challenge is, though, is that most of the data shows that they're not rising at a level that should provide enough homes for the population growth.
Okay.
Right. So population growth is still out. So if we look at it from a supply and demand, the data's telling us that the demand side is still outstripping the supply. There's still more and more population growth in terms of births and deaths and immigration. At an average, so Australia's current population or 2.6 people per dwelling. So if we look at that, for every 2.6 people the population grows by, we should have one extra dwelling being built. And we're not keeping up with that according to all of the major data.
Does that mean the prices are higher for properties because of the fact that there is such a demand and not enough being produced?
Well, that's the basic supply-demand theory is that if there's a shortage and there's more people wanting it, well, that pushes prices up.
Yeah, but drastically or?
Well, this is where I've got a bit of a theory that we'll come back to. So when we look at the demand side, and we'll come back to the supply because it matches up as well based on the type of supply and the type of demand. Obviously, we know there's multiple markets, there's areas, there's types of dwellings. So if we look at where the population growth is coming from, and I've got some interesting data here that sort of got me to talk about this topic. Australia's birth rate is actually the lowest on record at the moment.
Mm. Right.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
I thought it had ticked up again, but... obviously not.
No, lowest on record. Now, the interesting thing is it's a bit of a funny statistic to get your head around because it's the lowest on record as a birth rate, but there's more babies than ever.
Okay. So the millennial generation are having kids, but they're not having as many kids.
No. That's not how the data... sentence I just said is a little bit confusing if you don't understand how it plays out. So it's important to understand what the birth rate is first. Okay. So the birth rate is technically your fertility rate. Represents the total number of babies a woman could expect to have if the age-specific fertility rates for that year persisted through her lifetime.
Okay. Can you say that again?
Okay, so what it means, it's an average that it's at 1.74. So it means if you were within the birth-giving age range and you were to have a baby every year of that, how many babies would we have? And it's 1.7 per person. So that 1.7 is low compared to our history.
Okay.
So the birth rate is basically saying, for every woman that could have a baby, they're going to have 1.7. Mm. Okay.
Okay.
That rate has fallen from the peak of 2.02 in 2008.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So we are lower, but there's more babies than ever because our population's so much greater.
Right.
So that's where it's an oxymoron. So there's a lower percentage of people having babies, but because our population's greater than ever, there's more babies.
Yeah. Mm.
Fair enough.
Does that make sense?
I can understand that.
Okay. So that's one part of the population.
And I think there's a lump of population. There's a high proportion of people in that 25 to 45-year-old range right now in our population.
Yes.
I think there's a bit of a spike in that number.
Yep. And it's a lot of babies. So the last data we've got as a full year was 2018. 316,000 births were registered.
Right. All goes well for our baby bunting stock pick.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. And don't forget, these are just births. These are not, of course, with immigration, there's going to be families that are migrating, not just individuals that are adults. So there's probably even more babies, per year added to our population. So that number was 6,000 more than the previous year. But, of course, the actual the number of births per, women in the fertility range is lower. So a confusing stat, but one that plays into the overall picture of population growth, because currently Australia's population is approximately 30% immigration as a whole. So that's not the current rate of migration and population growth. But if you look at everyone that lives in Australia right now, 30% of them were born overseas.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, I would believe that.
Yeah. And that trend is growing, that we're heading, upwards of that. So more and more people are migrating than we are giving natural births or any births here. Mm. So as our population grows, which is growing at about 380,000 to 400,000 people per year, the bulk of that is still net migration from overseas.
Okay.
So now if I'm crystal balling all this and coming back to the dwelling approvals, the majority of the dwelling approvals that have happened recently are high density, meaning apartments. Okay. Now, the theory I'm sort of going to propose here is a couple of things. Firstly, that given the majority of the population is immigration and a lot of people are coming to Australia probably aren't that wealthy when they're coming over, so they're needing to buy affordable housing. Okay.
Yep.
Now, if I'm going to try and meet a market as a developer, I'm probably going to want to produce affordable housing. Therefore, I'm going to produce apartments, the cheapest stock I can put on the market that people can afford. So the challenge I see in terms of property investment is how do I decide what to invest in long term, knowing these two sort of factors? So my theory is that apartments are almost going to become a commodity in capital cities, that it's almost going to be like consumption. People buy it, they use it, they move on.
Yeah.
So when we think there's people that are coming through, so young people might finally be able to afford it, people migrating might say, well, they're used to high density and high population, so they'll come, they'll buy an apartment. As they become more affluent and have a bit more wealth, they'll probably get desire to have, a little bit more space around them and probably move to a location that's not as dense and, get away from more and more of the traffic. That's my theory then. So I would say that apartments in and around high density areas, so, the likes of the Melbourne CBD, Docklands, maybe South Yarra, in Sydney you've got the CBD, North Sydney and even out to Parramatta, they're probably only going to grow at the rate of CPI in my opinion because they'll just produce more. So the only way the price can grow is if the cost of producing more continues to rise.
Yep, sure.
So I don't think you'll see a lot of growth in terms of demand growth because they'll just keep producing it in line with the demand.
Yep.
But what I do believe will happen in the residential market is that as those people are wanting to get out of apartments, you know, if you start to get more money, or, you know, you marry and therefore you've got two wages, you'll probably want a better lifestyle. You'll want more space. You probably won't want to be in a congested area, and you'll look for a better property, a bigger property. Mm. And you may look to therefore a townhouse or even a house on some land.
That's what, sure, I was going to ask though. Townhouse is like just a smaller house. Instead,
a smaller house. But it's a definite step up from an apartment. Yeah. It's your own. You've got your privacy and your own domain. You've got your own title. Yeah. So it's definitely a step up for most people from apartments. Mm. And when doing that, I would think that – so the two types of properties I think will do really well over the next 5 to 10 years, and then there's a caveat to this as well in terms of where, is obviously going to be townhouses and houses versus apartments.
Mm.
Okay. Obviously with apartments, something really unique where it's low, you know, that's only one or two levels, it's been around for a while and it could have development potential, or you've got a big courtyard at the back, it's still considered an apartment, but it's more like a villa.
Yep.
They're still going to have some potential growth. The other part that I think is going to play out is we're probably going to see some regional areas do quite well.
Mm,
because a lot of these people that are looking for affordability, they'll look at an apartment in, say, Melbourne, that they might be able to get a one or two bedroom apartment for under $500,000. Or they could look at Ballarat, for example, and say, well, I can buy a house 5 minutes from the CBD in Ballarat for under $400,000 and have a backyard and have three or four bedrooms and have it brand new.
Yeah,
so I think regional areas and houses and townhouses around the capitals will be the ones that will see growth. And I think apartments around the high density areas will only grow according to what the CPI can do.
What about, I mean, you've touched on Ballarat as an example.
An
example, but where do you think these regional growth centres will be?
Look, I'll speak for Victoria mainly because I know it better. I think Geelong is a really good one because you've got the gateway to some really good lifestyle down on the Great Ocean Road and the Surf Coast. But the problem with Geelong already is that it's already had a bit of a run in terms of pricing. So in terms of affordability, a three or four bedroom house in the good areas of Geelong is probably already up above $600,000.
Mm-hmm.
So if you compare that to your likes of Ballarat and Bendigo, which I believe are the
cold.
It is cold, but funnily enough, it is in high demand at the moment. More and more people are seeing it as attractive because the train there's pretty reliable. They're doing upgrades on it, and it's only going to get faster. So there's a number of people that are buying three and four bedroom houses in new estates there for you know, under $400,000 in some examples.
Well, can I give you a bit of an analogy, not an analogy, but a bit of a story. Just this week, we went out to see my father for a birthday for my stepsister, and it took us through a couple of detours because there's quite a fair bit of infrastructure being
roadworks
and those types of things. So we were sent on all sorts of different detours to get out to Hurstbridge. You know where Hurstbridge is, at the end of the Hurstbridge line? Usually it would take me probably about 45 to 50 minutes to get out there, and it took me an hour and 40 minutes to get out there. Oh. Now, I can get to Ballarat on the freeways and the highways in about an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes.
Yep.
You're missing the fact that it was in one of the worst storms ever.
Oh, still.
But that's still becoming typical. Our infrastructure, even though there's a lot of work with our infrastructure being, you know, the railway removals and some freeways and things, that work's going on, which is creating even more congestion because they're doing it.
But I still remember when I used to catch a lift in with Mum into the city when she was working. This would be 20 years ago, and we lived in Panton Hill, and it'd usually take 50 minutes to get into the city from there, and peak hour traffic would take probably about an hour and 20 minutes. Now, if you're going from Ballarat and you've got the freeway and you've got a really, you know, fairly smooth ride all the way into the ring road and then into, you know, over the West Gate, an hour and a half to an hour and 40 minute commute, it's a long trip, but, you know, it's not undoable or not doable. If you have a job in the city.
And
if you can find some form of compromise, we've even got a client here where we've got where she lives in Castlemaine, and she does 3 days a week in the city and 2 days a week from home, and she'll commute into the city on those 3 days and work a couple of days from home.
Yeah.
And an hour and 20 commute on a train when you're just sitting in the one seat the whole time.
Yeah.
You can pull out your laptop and absolutely. You can get an hour's worth yeah. of work done.
Yep. Yep.
Or watch Netflix.
Or watch Netflix. Yep.
And, but an hour and 20 commute for most for people on the outer suburbs of Melbourne.
That's the way it is.
That's probably what yeah, it would it be is. From door
not,
to door.
Not yep. a lot different. Yeah.
And it's a stressful hour and 20 for a lot of those people.
Yeah. Well, you're standing yeah. most of the time as well.
Yeah.
Yep.
So true.
Squashed yes. like a sardine on the yeah. train.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
So I think Ballarat's a good one because it's still within that relevant time frame. Mm. Bendigo's another great city that I think people would like Bendigo. To live in, but it's got another half hour trip on it typically to get there. If that train upgrade gets it down under that hour and a half, I'd say that would be in more demand as well. And of course Geelong's already under the hour on the train, but of course it's already more expensive. Mm. So they're the kinds of cities and it's different. In Sydney, I don't know as many of the regional areas. Obviously, yeah. Newcastle's a really nice town that's got a lot of opportunity.
Beautiful spot.
Yeah.
But so, I think that's already sort of started to boom as well.
It has.
And that's really
for the same sort of reason Geelong has, I think. Yeah, similar sort of type of environment.
Great coastline.
Great coastline. And,
good,
yep.
Access good family.
To Nelson's Bay is right there. It's, yeah, it's good. And I guess Newcastle and Geelong being the two that we've just discussed are probably the better ones when we compare them to, say, the likes of a Ballarat or Bendigo because there's a lot more jobs already there. So people could live there and work there. Mm. Whereas a lot of the time when people are probably looking to move to the likes of a Ballarat, they're still looking to maybe work in the CBD.
Of course.
Which you can do in Geelong, but, yeah, Geelong's still got a lot more jobs.
Albeit we went out for a lunch before Christmas time and there was dinner before Christmas with our architects.
Yep.
And they were alluding to the fact that government is looking at Ballarat to set up various departments out in the regional areas.
Yep.
They trialled it and I think they still have the ATO have an office in Albury,
yep.
But more and more government departments are slated to move out into those regional towns to be the employment hub and to be an anchor out there.
And I think that would be one of the best things to watch if you're thinking of investing in a regional town. Find out where a big government or a big corporate is going to be putting a new factory, office, something. Because if that creates more jobs, I think that'll definitely create more demand for housing.
Yep.
Good advice.
Mm.
All right, we're going to throw to another quick break and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, guys. We're now going to throw over to Louis. He's got a couple of New Year things that he's going to discuss.
I do. Happy New Year.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. The first thing I was told by my wife who read this online, it's a bit of a public service announcement. When you're signing and dating documents, what's today's date? The 17th of January. So you write 17/1/20.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you write 20 on the end of it, that is a manipulatable number.
Yeah. Because 20 in the end of that.
You can write, if you've written 20, someone else can come along and write a 19 after your 20 and make it look like you signed it last year, or they can make it look like you signed it next year or something like that.
Think about that.
Good public health warning.
Yeah, that's
so we have
right.
to use all four digits.
So use all four digits. And one thing is the potential for fraud. But I struggle to think of how that would affect a lot of people. Maybe there's some important business documents or
wills being signed just before.
That's what
it would
thinking.
Open up disputes more than anything.
That's right. So I'm thinking of documents that could go to a court of law. So especially wills. And what courts are very sensitive to is not so much whether it's a case of fraud, but whether it's a case of intent or not. And if it's not a complete date or there's some kind of ambiguity if with a will, if it's ambiguous, then they're more likely to rule it out.
Yeah.
So I'd say if you're signing wills and powers of attorneys or any document that you think might end up in a court of law, then put down all four digits.
Fascinating.
Good one.
Yeah.
Very smart. Very smart.
And of course, if you would like a certain document to maybe be valid this year and next year and the year after, you could validly sign it with a 2-0 and then just add a little 2-1 next year and 2-2 the year after as well. I'll just use this one forever.
Love it.
I'd like to put that on as the expiry of any subscription I've got. Yeah. I paid up until 2021. Yeah.
Self-managed super fund investment strategies.
That reminds me of the husband who would always tell his wife he'd be home from the pub at 5:30.
Yeah. It's a great
1 hour.
Great. I try that one.
I've got one that does that too. Yeah. Often the trains are always delayed too.
Not often, always.
Always.
Or just cancel.
You know how bad it is.
Very unlucky.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. And if it's that last train of the night, if you miss that one, well, you just have to be out until 5 a.m.
Right. Yeah. What else are you going to do?
So the other thing I wanted to shout out to was all procrastinators.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone who got to the end of last year and thought, oh, these things didn't get done, but I guess I've got this holiday time and some fresh mental space to do it. Well, now we're most of the way through January.
Damn.
By next week, we'll be up to Australia Day.
Yeah.
And after Australia Day, there's a week after that. So here's my tip for that. If you are a procrastinator, then make the first step an easy one. And make it a step which does commit you to a process of subsequent steps.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say don't make your first step. In order to do this job, I need to do some research. Mm-hmm. I need to go online and sit for an hour and compare apples and oranges and think of what I'm going to do. So that's a bad first step because that's a big job and you're not really sure what the outcome's going to be. I would say make the first step a one small action which commits you to something else. So if you've wanted to, I don't know, refinance your mortgages, don't start going online and comparing interest rates. Just make your first step a phone call to a mortgage broker.
Yeah.
Step one, done. It's done in 5 minutes and your booking is scheduled and then you're on your way.
Mm.
And then you start on that process and the next steps just naturally happen because you've engaged with the process where you are guided through it.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my tip for the new year.
Nice one.
Good one.
Nice one. Yeah. You thinking of losing a few pounds or a few kilos?
Yeah.
Cut them out now.
Book in your gym membership or get your
We've already done
F45.
Yeah. Yeah. There you are. Just do one session. Yeah.
Take the first step.
Yep, exactly. Don't commit to a year-long program because that's a big thing, but just do one session.
One session.
And then just leave it open for whatever might happen. And then you might never go back. But you need to commit to the process.
Yeah.
So you need to be open to the longer-term process. Mm. Oh, come on, Steph.
I know. I was going to say just don't sign up to any gym memberships because
you'll probably have five of them like Steph.
Paint the pool and,
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the gyms are trying to cash in on this time of year too. When I went for a walk yesterday, I think I went to get lunch and there was a couple of people spruiking right out the front of the gym trying to get people signed up.
They make you feel bad. They're like, you put on like 5 kilos.
Yeah. Always book in the next step.
Yeah.
So if you're going to buy a gym membership, sign up to a weekly class.
And then don't turn up.
Or a personal training session. No, oh, God damn.
Yeah.
Work with me.
There's a trend going here, Steph. You need an accountability partner.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like.
Exactly.
I can commit to the first step.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
You need someone else to hold you.
Well, then the problem is our accountability partner lacks accountability.
They're both easily swayed.
Yeah. All right. So obviously a group class doesn't work. What you need is a personal trainer
to drag
who
you out
one
of bed.
On one is going to call your ass and drag you out of bed.
Yeah, great.
Knock on your door and say, Steph, go
Get
running.
Up. Yeah. Awful.
That's it.
What you need.
That's it.
I remember there was a golf coach that used to always say, oh, if that doesn't work, take a couple of days off and then quit.
There you go. Lovely. I want to touch on a bit of news. So last year we had a few new bits of legislation come in around consolidating superannuation accounts automatically if the balance was low and hadn't received contributions in a while and was deemed inactive. Well, there's now some data on how well this program has worked in the ATO's eyes. As at the 21st of November last year, the ATO has received more than 2.3 million inactive superannuation accounts.
So, sorry, how does the ATO get that? It just registers that there's not enough?
So the ATO, so the government put out legislation to superannuation funds saying if the balance is under $6,000, and hasn't received a contribution and hasn't had any other form of activity, then it is now to be classified as an inactive account.
Right.
If it's an inactive account under these measures, then you have to transfer it to the ATO.
Okay.
So it's a legal requirement of public super funds, industry funds, retail funds.
And you don't, like, what about interest eating into that? So you're not going to get, I mean, if you wanted to claim that money, what happens at the end of that?
Because well, here's what happens. So when it goes to the ATO, it used to sit with the ATO as a lost super account, but it's linked to your tax file number. So anyone can log into their MyGov account and you can look at your superannuation accounts and you'll see, oh, there's lost super here. Should I send it to one of my active super accounts? Okay. And the ATO has actually started doing this automatically. So
they're not even better.
Of 2.3 million inactive accounts that they've received, 1.1 million accounts have automatically gone to a person's active super account.
Okay.
So that's $1.8 billion of the total $2.16 billion. So it's not like the ATO is hanging on to the majority of it to put in their coffers. So they've received these inactive accounts. Half of the accounts, but the majority of the money has gone into what the ATO already knows is an active account.
But you physically have to go in there, log onto your system?
No, not with these. This program is automated.
Wow.
Previously, it has been a manual thing where the ATO holds onto the money, but this is automatic. And almost 500,000 accounts, 456,000 accounts, have been paid directly to individuals because they are over 65 or retired or eligible to receive a direct payment.
Yep.
So that's another $274 million. So there's still a little bit of money on the table, maybe $100 million or so out of the $2.16 billion, which is sitting with the ATO. But I think from the regulator's eyes, they would call it a raging success.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. And I'd agree with that in the big picture. The only concern I have, which was mentioned in the podcasts last year, is for individuals to make sure that if they do have an account that they're holding onto for insurance purposes, make sure it's not going to be automatically closed down. So you have to opt in to those super funds keeping those accounts open.
Yeah.
And you'll be receiving mail and emails about opting in. And this will now happen every 6 months as a regular occurrence. So keep opting in. Keep your eye on your super account and maybe make small contributions to be absolutely sure or do something to keep your accounts in place if that's what you need to do.
That is really good advice.
Definitely. Yeah.
Terrific. Good stuff.
All right. Well, look, we might now follow up with our favourite segment for the day, and that is...
our first one for the year.
You can't be serious. You cannot now, be serious. Who would like to start? I know you're all loved
chomping
this
at the bit. Well, any car lovers in the room? Well, there might be some car loving listeners.
I like cars. I don't like cars. Owning cars.
Yeah, driving.
I like looking at cars.
Looking at.
Yeah.
Well, look, this isn't nice necessarily cars. About a car that's super sexy. It's more about when manufacturers release a new model or a new version, they might give it an extra name. Like it might be the Toyota Camry Limited Edition or the such and such edition.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So at the Singapore 2020 Motor Show, Subaru came out with a new edition for their Forester. But they didn't quite think it through appropriately in terms of the acronym that it would get named. So the name that they gave it was the Special Edition with the Forester Ultimate Customized Kit.
Oh, no, you're kidding
me. So let's just go through those four words. First letter of each. Forester, ultimate, customised kit.
You're kidding me.
So I've got the Subaru Forester fuck edition.
Oh, you're kidding me.
I love that. That's like
seriously.
The best PR ever, and you didn't even realise it.
Well, maybe they wrote it in another language to start with, and then when they translated it to English, they realised that's what it was.
Maybe they did know, Steph.
Maybe they did know.
Maybe they did.
Maybe they knew.
There you go, it's free advertising. Yeah.
Someone good probably PR. Did.
Yeah.
Yep. The person leaving the company.
Yeah. Going, oh, let's see if we can get this one through.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like, do you remember that?
They probably already got the badge made up, ready to put on the back.
Do you remember that that Malaysian Airlines news reporter, or the news reporter was reporting on the Malaysian Airlines crash, and and they were coming out with the name of the pilots.
Some I know a dodgy one.
Holy fuck.
Yes.
Crash ding bing or something like that.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Yeah. Lack of research on that account. Oh, there's been plenty of plays on names.
Yes, there has.
So well played, Subaru.
Yeah, well done.
Well done. So some corporate fraud has led to a warning from an instrument maker.
Yeah.
How do you tie those two together?
Mm.
Well, former executive of Nissan, another car manufacturer, accused of misappropriating company funds, has been wanted in Japan.
He's the guy that fled.
Yeah.
Is that him?
Fled. Yeah. That's right. Fled to Lebanon in a way which has caused a warning from Yamaha, the instrument manufacturer, not to hide in their instrument cases.
Correct.
Because this is how he escaped.
That's right. I did hear this. Yeah.
Jumped into a big instrument case. I don't know which one. I imagine it was a double bass. Because you'd struggle to fit into a flute case.
Yeah.
To the point where Yamaha has said, well, if people are going to hide in instrument cases, we know that one day someone's probably going to die from it.
Yeah. They'll
be
like
accidentally
that.
Locked in.
Yeah.
So we'll put out a warning now because we'd feel really bad if we didn't and then someone did have a bad accident.
That's incredible.
Surreal, yeah. All the new music cases are going to have these stickers on them now. Just see.
Warning. Do not hide in.
May cause death.
Wow.
May cause deportation.
I got nothing for
you
today.
Nothing.
No. I'm still on holidays, guys. Yeah. My brain's. I'll be back soon.
Well, there's only one way to go for you this year, Joel, isn't there?
The only way's up. Thank you, everyone, for your input this morning, and to our listeners for listening and tuning in. And Joel will be back next week. Hopefully,
you'll join us.
Hopefully, you'll join us.
Joel will be joining us
or
next
else you'll
week.
Be in the instrument case to try and get away. Anyway, have a fabulous weekend, and we will be back next week.
Thanks, Steph.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.